I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City's 5th District includes a number of neighborhoods in the southeastern part of the city. Today, current Councilman Lee Barnes and challenger Dwayne Williams will ask each candidate their thoughts on tax incentives, violence, affordable housing, and what Kansas City should be doing to fight climate change. Then, injuries are common occurrences for professional athletes. Unfortunately, they're becoming normal for younger players as well. We'll learn about injury concerns for these early competitors and what coaches can be doing to keep them healthy. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City's 5th District covers much of the southeastern portion of the city and contains any number of distressed neighborhoods. Two candidates are running for the district's at-large position, meaning that voters citywide will be voting on them come June 18th. Now an opportunity to meet both and get a sense of their priorities going forward. With us, Councilman Lee Barnes is the incumbent in this race. He's an engineer, businessman, and former school board member. Councilman, nice to have you again. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Dwayne Williams is also running. He's president of the 12th Street Development Corporation, which has a mission of providing quality and affordable housing for residents. Dwayne, nice to have you too. Good morning.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Steve.
I want to begin by focusing on statements that the two of you gave to the Star several weeks ago. Lee Barnes, you're the incumbent, so I'll give you first shot here. You wrote in the newspaper, on the city council, I've gotten things done. And I'm wondering, what have you gotten done?
Well, we've done several things in terms of dealing with climate change, which is interesting that you just had the young lady on the program there. We've got a resolution in place that we're going to move towards all of our passenger vehicles being electric vehicles by the year 2024. We've signed an agreement with KCPL in which all of the electricity that we purchase will be from non-fossil fuels. Just on that end, I've gotten some things done in terms of development on the east side, which is not been happening very much at all.
Yeah. And you point to what exactly on the east side?
Well, we've got a development on the east side, 63rd and Prospect, right, which has been sitting dormant for 12 to 15 years. We've got a developer coming in now named Urban America. And we've got a development that's going to be upwards of $150 million. It's going to consist of a hotel, affordable housing, student housing for research nursing school, and a couple of restaurants. So that's all in place. It's all in play now. It's been developed. All the drawings and things are in place. We've got an engineering contract that's already been out. The RFP has been let, and we've got the responses back.
Dwayne Williams, in the same piece, you wrote this: we need a change in Kansas City and a city council person who's on your side. What did you mean by that?
Well, I think, first of all, I think everywhere I've traveled, you know, the same thing they've heard is that their council people are non-responsive. They don't see them at meetings. I was at a Northland meeting, and they said in 4 years they've never seen their council person to represent the 5th District at large. Hmm. You know, so when people tell me things like that, that means that there's opportunities to be out there. There's opportunities to listen to people. There's opportunities to see other sides and other point of views from Kansas City.
Yeah.
And not just the inner city, but Kansas City as a whole. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm running, because I want to be a voice for the people, but also want to make sure that I'm there when the people need me.
Lee Barnes, you want to respond to that?
Well, I mean, I don't think that's necessarily true. I mean, I've been one to work, number one, with all of my colleagues on the council. And I've been to several meetings all across the city. So, you know, when you talk about someone who's accessible, my one of the things that's been said about my office is that it's very accessible. You get a call back from my office when you don't get called back from people in other offices or other districts. So,
right. Dwayne, give me a sense of your professional experience and how that's prepared you for a seat on the city council.
Well, I think my resume will speak for itself. I mean, basically, I've done a little bit of everything, for profit and nonprofit. Been president and CEO of a couple of different organizations. Now I serve as president and CEO of a development corporation, which has given me the opportunity to be on EDC's board for about six and a half years. So I've kind of understand the economic development piece of the city. I've served on different boards throughout the community, whether that's EDC, whether that's NTDF, whether it's the Port Authority's minority board. So I've served on those boards. So it gives me some understanding as to what takes place in Kansas City, but also how I can best utilize my tools and my skill set in Kansas City. And so when you look at the things that I've accomplished, the things we've done, we have a mentoring program at 12th Street as well for youth. And we also have a reentry program that we started about 8 years ago for our young men and women coming out of the penal system. So I think I get an opportunity to see all aspects of the city, and I've worked with all aspects of the city.
Lee Barnes, same question. What about your professional experience has prepared you to continue your service on the council?
Well, I mean, from my experience as a school board member, from my experience serving on the council now, from my experience as an engineer working in corporate America, from my experience as a the director of operations for a nonprofit organization who has an understanding of how the nonprofit world as well as the corporate world can work together to get things done in the city, my resume is full of understanding the things that will give you an understanding of how I can interject and position myself to work with my colleagues to get things done. When we talk about one of the issues that we deal with now with in terms of infrastructure, I've been one of the leading voices in terms of talking about how we should best structure that whole thing in terms of getting streets repaved,
right,
snow removal and all of those things. So I'm well-versed in terms of dealing with all of those aspects of things that we'll we need to address as a city council.
I'm visiting with the two candidates for the 5th District at-large position on Kansas City City Council. Councilman Barnes, you proposed a plan to lower city water bills through a 3/8-cent sales tax. Why do you want to go in that direction? What are you trying to achieve there?
Well, and that's one of the things that we were looking at as a way of dealing with the water bills that were increasing 9% year over year. And one of the things that we have been able to do is reduce that amount of increase. So we may not need to do that. But I was using that as an example of something we could do rather than the necessarily the early childhood. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about, we had limited resources in terms of the ability for us to increase the taxes. And why would we increase the taxes for early childhood when that's not something that's necessarily within the purview of the city council?
Mm-hmm.
But things like water bills, again, we're at a point where we have some of our elders paying upwards of 20% of their net incomes on water bills. And that's just not sustainable.
Hey, Dwayne, is that a good idea, the 3/8-cent sales tax to deal with water bills? Would that have been a good idea?
Well, I don't know. I mean, because that's something that the councilman, you know, looked at, and that's something that he liked to do. You know, one of the major things I like to do is work with the water department, understand what's causing the bills to be so high. I mean, I understand we have EPA, you know, violations and regulations they have to deal with, but also know that around 2020, 2021, you know, some of those are going to stable out as well. But I think we all agreed that we don't want the same type of water issues that they were having in Michigan as well,
right,
up in Flint and some of those other places. So I think if it's going to cost us a little bit more to have clean, safe, livable water, I think I'm willing to pay a little extra, but also understand from the seniors' perspective and those who are just having struggles paying their water bills. You know, it's something that the city needs to look at, but we also need to look at the water department and ask, is it because the bills are continuing to increase because people are behind paying their bills? Is it the ones that are paying the bills, having to subsidize the ones who are not paying their bills? I think those are all things that we need to look at and get an understanding from the water department what's the best way to move forward.
Did either one of you support the 3/8-cent sales tax for early childhood education that Mayor James championed?
I did not.
I did not, but I do support early education childhood.
Yeah.
Early childhood education.
But that
yes.
particular plan you weren't crazy about.
I wasn't.
Yeah. In its endorsement of you in March, Lee Barnes, the Star said it had some misgivings about you because you had not held the line on incentives for luxury developers. What about that?
Well, I think they were talking in terms of projects that have been development agreements that have been agreed upon since 2003, 2007.
Right.
And what we were trying to do, myself and most of my colleagues, were to renegotiate some of those deals. And that's what we've been doing from day one. We have not had a deal come in with us that has a development agreement that we've just totally agreed with and not tried to renegotiate the deal.
Yeah.
One of the things is that in the development agreement, if you look at the Cordish deal, they have a 99-year agreement. Well, we renegotiated that deal down to 40-some-odd years, down from an unlimited number of—
This is the Power and Light District downtown we're talking about.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
So unlimited number of apartments that they could do within that 99 years to where we would negotiate it down to where they're going to only be able to do five or six.
Yeah.
So those are kind of— those are the kind of adjustments that we were trying to make to most of those deals.
You know, Dwayne Williams, there's been lots of talk about incentives for developers in this campaign. I'm wondering, going forward, in your view, is there still a place for incentives for downtown development, or has the time come to stop those incentives going forward?
Well, I think if you remember what Kansas City looked like 20, 25 years ago, I think we can say, you know, maybe all the incentives wasn't necessary, but I will also say the incentives worked in downtown. Kansas City, and I believe now it's time to continue the incentives, but continue them in a different way and look at how they can benefit the east side and some of the west side of Kansas City.
Does that mean you would say no to continue downtown incentives?
No, that's not what that means. That means that I would look at it based off an individual need. You know, there's this thing called but for, you know, when you look at incentives, you know, but for with this project work. And then I think we probably take a look at how we revamp the scorecard, you know, and then, you know, the council, it comes before the council. So the council has to make that determination, you know, as to whether or not they want to give those incentives. But I believe incentives are necessary. We've been doing incentives in Kansas City for, well, the last 70, 75 years.
Yeah.
I think we have to understand and figure out how we make incentives work where economic development touches all part of Kansas City.
Lee Barnes, is there still a place for incentives for downtown projects in the next 4 years of the city council?
Yeah, I was one of the ones who worked on the incentive reform. And basically trying to give a new way of approaching incentives in order for the other taxing jurisdictions to have more say, to have get a better opportunity to negotiate with us and the developer on how we would approach the incentives.
Right.
So, but I don't think there is a standard. We're just going to need to cut all incentives. I think we need to approach them on a case-by-case basis and give some understanding of what incentives will actually need to work for the citizens.
You know, Dwayne Williams, what else needs to happen east of Truce to get a development going in that part of our city?
Well, I think there's a couple things. I think, one, when you talk about economic development, I think you have to look at how do we bring that to that side. And I think it starts with jobs as well. You know, those are things that you have to look at by development that are taking place in other areas. I think we have to make sure that our people in 3rd, 5th, 6th district, some of those districts, are getting jobs out of it. I think
how do you do that?
I think what we do is call Kansas City first. I think anytime tax incentives are given in Kansas City, I think the first priority ought to be hiring Kansas City's people. Mm-hmm. And I think we ought to set some type of policies in place where those individuals need to live in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. You know, I think when you give out tax incentives and then people go move to Johnson County and all the executives live in Johnson County, but they're getting the tax incentives from Kansas City, I think they need to be in Kansas City, Missouri. I think we hire those individuals first. I think we also, those major corporations that are doing the development, I think we get them to work with the smaller development corporations like the CDCs, and have them help us develop the east side of Kansas City. I think we give them an additional tax incentive for them to do that, to help the smaller corporations develop, and they build their status, and they're able to build and to work on the east side.
Councilman Lee Barnes, how do you get more development east of Truce?
Well, all of those things that Dwayne mentioned are in place. As a part of the scorecard, you get a higher score for bringing jobs to the city. You get a higher scorecard for the number of workers that are going to work who mm-hmm. live in Kansas City. So those things are in place. But what we have to do is marry the tools that we have. Now we have the 8-cent sales tax tool. Now we have opportunity zones. So we're going to have to continue to marry the tools. And one of the ways we were able to incentivize the developer of 63rd Street is using a marrying of all those tools and sending them to to bring some development that is needed. And we have to look at exactly what's needed in particular areas, and we can then incent those areas to be developed.
Lee Barnes and Dwayne Williams are my guests. They're the two candidates for the 5th District at-large seat on Kansas City's City Council. There's a question on the ballot in June that would cap the amount of property tax abatements available to assist developers at 50% of what's allowed by state law. Either one of you support that idea?
No, I don't.
I don't.
Neither one of you do. And why not, Dwayne?
Well, I just don't think when we talk about development, there's a cookie-cutter approach. I don't think every development deal is the same. Some may need, 75%. Some only may need 40%.
Right.
I think that but-for kind of tells us that in the scorecard. And I like what Councilman Bourne said. He said those things are already in place to help develop the east side of the city. Well, if they're already in place and, they've been in office 4 years now, why are we not developing the east side of the community? I mean, those are questions that you have to ask, because those are questions that the community is asking.
Councilman Barnes, why aren't we developing more on the east side of the city?
Well, you people think they're going to be able to get a rate of return. So, and with that, we have to have the tools there that folks think they're going to be able to do their development and also make their dollars back. And
they're not seeing it right now.
They're not seeing it, but I think we, with additional AFSCME sales tax, with the additional Opportunity Zone dollars, we're going to see now more development happening on the east side.
Because there is a lot of frustration out there.
A lot of frustration. I've been frustrated. I live only four blocks from the 63rd and Prospect area.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I sat and watched that prior to getting on council. I sat and watched that being dormant for all of that time. So that was one of the first things I did. So it's not been easy to entice or encourage development on that site.
Let's turn to a different issue. Dwayne Williams, what's the one issue you most want to see addressed during a four-year term in the city council? What are you most determined to work on?
Well, I mean, I think we just finished talking about economic development on the east side. Equity around the whole city. I think that's something that's needed.
Your view has been lacking.
I think when we look at equity, that may mean different things in different areas. For instance, what Northland may think is equity, they just want people to pick up their trash. So to them, that's equity. They're paying their taxes. They want their trash picked up. I mean, those are things that I think that we need to be responsive to, as a city council. And I think some of our council people haven't been responsible to that.
Mm-hmm.
I look at those things. I look at economic development on the east side. I look at employment on the east side. So those are things that I'm going to be working on, is trying to bring those things to a much needed area that's distressed right now.
Councilman Barnes, what would you point to? What's the one thing you're determined to get fixed in the next 4 years?
Well, the things that we're working on, like development on the east side. I mean, we've got projects that are happening. We have started working with two developers who are going to develop housing on the east side. One is a tract of land that's going to do about 40 houses on the east side. Another is going to be 100 and some odd houses on the east side, organization called Tyson Summit. So, there are things that are in the works, there are things that are happening that we will continue to work on. And then we have to look at affordable housing. How do we incentivize developers to bring that affordable housing into the urban core?
The city council, speaking of affordable housing, passed a resolution saying it wants to have a $75 million trust fund. Problem is, there's no money in the trust fund. How do you go forward under a circumstance like that when it comes to affordable housing?
Well, I mean, you develop. There's several things that you can talk about doing, and these discussions are going to have to be had with the entire council. One, you can look at a property tax, you can look at a sales tax, or you can look at redirecting dollars that are currently in the budget that we're paying for some other things.
Would you favor a sales tax to begin to or a property tax to begin dealing with affordable housing?
Well, I'm at a point of thinking and understanding that our citizens are weary of taxes, quite honestly. And so that will have to be a discussion that's going to take 6-8 months of having community discussion about that.
Yeah. Dwayne, you work in this area. What's the answer for affordable housing? Where do you get the money to do it?
I think one of the things right now, myself and 12th Street and Ollie Gates, OG Investment. I mean, we're looking at putting in between 14th and Garfield all the way over to Michigan, 24 new houses over there. And I think what we're looking at is doing is you know, take away affordable housing and make houses affordable. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that we're looking at, you know, and there's a soft spot in there, you know, but when you talk about affordable housing, but you also got to look at the area median income, you know, and when you look at that as a whole, you know, area median income is really high. And we know that that's not suitable to affordable housing. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to really restructure this, look at the Kansas City area numbers, what those numbers look like, and then adjust our affordable housing off of that point right there. And then, you know what we need to do? We need to use that 8-cent sales tax out there to help us develop with contractors that are willing to build houses that are affordable in the East Side.
This is the 8-cent sales tax that was passed a couple of years ago to improve the East Side. Mm-hmm. We just have a few minutes left. I want to turn to another topic that's on the minds of so many folks, and that's crime. What's the answer going forward, Councilman Barnes? You're looking at hiring more police officers, hotspot policing, community policing. Where do you want to go here in a second term?
I think community policing is kind of the start. We have to look at how do we have better communication between across all lines with the neighborhoods, with law enforcement. And I think we've just hired in each of the precincts community interactive officers, mm-hmm. as well as we've hired social workers. So those are the things that we can start with in terms of trying to get better relationships built between law enforcement and the community. And that's a start.
In the meantime, the crime rate, the violent crime rate in Kansas City continues to be at a place that no one wants it to be.
No one wants the crime to be, and I live in 64130, so I'm understanding of the need that we have to have in terms of community relations, in terms of how do we have conflict resolution and all of those things. And I think those things start by dealing with the community interactive officers and the social workers within the police force.
Dwayne Williams, what's your platform for dealing with violent crime in Kansas City and on the East Side particularly?
Well, I think community policing is one piece of the puzzle that I think, but I also think that we have to work in prevention programs. You know, that's extremely important. You know, we've got to teach our young people life skill training classes, but we also got to bring economic development and jobs to the inner core, inner city. Mm-hmm. I think those are the biggest issues. You know, let's put our people to work. People at work, that's less times on the street, you know. But if you don't have a job and you've got a bunch of people in the neighborhood, you know, you have no social skills, you have no prevention mechanisms in place, you're going to high crime, you know. And we've been watching this for the last 3 or 4 years. Our crime continues to escalate. Mm-hmm. You know, the question is, do we want another 4 years of escalating crime?
You know, want to hire more police officers?
You know, well, you know, I think maybe refocus some of the police officers and hire more people that are working in desk jobs and bring some of those officers back out on the streets. You know, shot fire technology is a good thing, you know, to be able to pinpoint where the shot's fired, you know, but after the shot's fired, that's too late. So I think the prevention, you know, really needs to be put in place. And you have to start that with our young people in our classes.
Just quickly, Lee, more police officers?
We've put more funding for more police officers in the budget last year, and we're hiring 20 new police officers. So that's a start. I don't know if we're going to necessarily continue to be able to do that every year because that's a kind of an expensive deal.
Yeah.
But that's a start, and I think we'll have to reevaluate that after 6 months or so.
Okay, those are the views and voices of the two candidates for Kansas City's 5th District at-large seat. Councilman Lee Barnes, Dwayne Williams is challenging him. They'll be on the June 18th ballot, a chance to deal and cast your make your opinions known at that time. Thank you both for coming in and sharing your views. I sure appreciate it. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Okay, time for a break. When we come back, are year-round sports undermining our young athletes? We'll find out. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday on the show, Jolie Justice shared her plans to transform the use of development incentives and why criminal justice reform is needed to address crime in the city. Hear more about her bid for mayor at kcur.org/up to date. Wednesday on the show, we'll talk to Kansas City's other mayoral candidate, Quentin Lucas, about his plans to provide residents with a safer and more affordable city. Join us tomorrow for that conversation on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the increase in year-round sports is leading to new sets of injury issues with young athletes. One is called Little League Shoulder. That results from youngsters throwing too much without taking a break. Young athletes typically need time off from a sport spanning at least 3 months. Year-round sports is a natural outgrowth of our intensely competitive society, and maybe a parent's hope that their youngster is on his way to becoming the next great Major League All-Star pitcher. With us to talk about injury concerns in young athletes are Dr. John Johnson, who serves as the athletic director at Shawnee Mission South, where he also teaches government, economics, and law. He's also coached baseball. Dr. Johnson, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Randy Goldstein's also here. He's a pediatrician and sports injury specialist over at St. Luke's. Dr. Goldstein, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, why are we seeing injuries earlier in youth, Dr. Johnson? I mean, what's different in how kids are playing now versus, say, 10 years ago?
Well, I think the biggest part of it is the year-round demand on these young
athletes. They're not getting a break.
They're not. They go from one sport to another, and many times, probably in the last 5 years, the big phenomenon is they'll double book themselves. They'll be in a high school sport and in volleyball, for example, but then being played club soccer.
Dr. Goldstein, you're nodding your head as Dr. Johnson's talking. You've seen some of this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not only is the single sport getting more yearly growth and not having the summer break as we used to, but they're perhaps playing more than one sport, or like Dr. Johnson said, playing on more than one team in the same sport.
Mm-hmm. Is that kind of concentration a good idea? What would you advise a parent?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that we're having less fun and having more competition. And when we can reverse that equation to having more fun and concentration less on competition, we'll get more wins in the end.
Less fun and more competition. Does that ring a bell to you, Dr. Johnson?
Absolutely. I think it's very clear by the research that kids participate in sports mainly by far to have fun. That doesn't mean they don't need to be held accountable for behavior and being coachable. But the bottom line is if they don't have fun, my experience is by the time they become sophomores, juniors, seniors in high school, they start to burn out.
Yeah.
If it's not fun, in high school, you can find a million other things you'd like to do.
I was going to say, there's some stat out there that suggests that so many kids aren't sticking with sports these days because they burn out, to use your term.
Well, they burn out. There's a lot of research out there that indicates that kids leave because they've had a bad experience with a parent or a coach. There's a research that I give my parents when we have our meetings that indicate, for example, that the part of the athletic experience the kids don't like the most is the ride home after the game. So the bottom line,
meaning that the mom or dad is letting them have it.
They are. They're breaking down the game. They want to talk about it, and the kids just want to go get something to eat. Mm-hmm. And they'll deal with it another time. And I think it's just really important to understand that fun is what engages these kids, and it becomes the link for their activity.
And to what extent are you seeing parents becoming a bigger and bigger issue as the years pass in your work?
Well, you know, 97% of our parents are outstanding and they just let it happen. I think that the parents that vicariously want to experience the success of a of a child, it can be harmful to that child. It puts a lot of undue pressure on that child because for that child, they're excellence in sports may just be a byproduct of what they want to do. It's not who they are.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, Dr. Goldstein, let's talk about young pitchers and what should be the limit on how much they pitch and how often. I mentioned in the opening this whole idea of little league shoulder. What are you seeing out there and what would you advise a parent of a pitcher?
Good. So little league elbow and little league shoulder are both injuries to an open growth plate that widens because of too much stress or too many throws. That is common, and we've seen it for the eternity of baseball. Perhaps we're seeing it more because of shows like this educating parents and coaches to look for it, and so they're better at coming to the doctor when their child is not throwing as accurately or is having pain. possibly also because of what was mentioned earlier, that they're playing more often, and so we're seeing it more often because kids are getting hurt in their winter off-season throwing practices. And maybe because they're playing on two teams, and maybe the coach doesn't even know that they just pitched the day before on another team. And so when
and that happens, you got kids who are pitching in a game one day and coming back for the high school team and pitching in that game the next day?
For sure, although I mean, that's not the recommendations.
Right, that just strikes me as a recipe for all kinds of issues.
Well, certain people's goals are very high, and in those rules, the more you play, the better chance I have to succeed becomes the rule.
Yeah.
And often an injury gets in the way of that.
What do you recommend in terms of how much pitching any one youngster should be undertaking?
Good. So there's recommendations by the American Academy of Pediatrics as well as Major League Baseball and all the youth baseball leagues that fall under Major League Baseball. And there's pitch counts based on your age, and there's times to take breaks, including not going just from a pitching position to a catching position the next inning. Because although a catcher doesn't have the velocity and direction necessary, they have just the amount of frequency of throws.
Mm-hmm.
So taking days off after pitching, taking a month off at a time, up to 3 months a year at a month staggered each time to give the arm a rest, but also to give not only the arm a rest, the brain a rest too, to get a chance to recover from that sport before going to the next season.
Dr. Johnson, how often are you seeing Little League shoulder cropping up in your work at Shawnee Mission South?
Well, I don't see it in the context of Dr. Goldstein, but what we do see, the Kansas State High School Activity Association has passed pitch count rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have more kids that are pitchers now, which I think is kind of by demand. But those limits are pretty strict, and I haven't seen what I consider to be really dead arms or anything like that recently. The coaches are pretty well in tune with appropriate use of their pitchers in high school.
What is a typical pitch count for a junior in high school? Do you know off top of
well,
your head?
Well, you're maxed out at 105 pitches.
That's still a lot of pitches.
It is a
lot of pitches. That's a major league count. That's what the major leaguers go for.
And then they're off. They have to take a mandatory off 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
And you gradually go down. I think it's 49, and then you can pitch 2 days later.
Mm-hmm.
And you gradually go up.
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you, Dr. Goldstein?
That's the normal guideline is 105 in high school. Realize that Little League elbow and Little League shoulder, you have to have an open growth plate. And so many of those patients are junior high and grade school kids. And by the time they make it to high school, their growth plates are closed. And they're having new problems like ulnar collateral ligament tears, what the Tommy John surgery comes from, and other issues that don't have to do with the growth plate. So
Tommy John surgery, you hear so much about that at the major league level. You're associated with it too, even at the high school level?
At the high school and college level for sure. And there are some places, not that I'm aware of in Kansas City, but there are some places in the country that do prophylactic ulnar collateral ligament surgeries.
What does that
before
mean?
The injuries even happen. They replace it with something stronger because they're so sure their kid's going to go to the major leagues.
Get out of here. To actually do it as a preventative.
Not that I'm aware of in Kansas City, but in the United States, yes.
Well, that's breathtaking to me. Yeah. Well, we're talking about youth sports and injuries associated with those sports. If you want to join our conversation, we have a couple of great experts here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dr. Goldstein, Little League shoulders from throwing, you know, an excessive overhead motion. Does it happen to softball players too? Are you seeing that as well?
It's a great question. So we see Little League shoulder and Little League elbow mostly in the overhead athlete, which would include baseball pitchers, number one. But it happens in position players as well, in softball and baseball, and happens in the gymnast because it's an overhead athlete, happens in some track events such as javelin or shot put. It's anything that we're doing excessively under a load, so under a weight or under an excessive, over and over force with open growth plates. So it doesn't just happen to baseball pitchers, but that's certainly the majority of what we see.
Yeah. You know, John Johnson, again, at Shawnee Mission South, what are you seeing in terms of overall participation in sports these days at your high school? Is it on the way up? Is it staying steady, dropping? What's happening?
I would say it would essentially be static and on the way up. I don't see any reduction in the numbers of participation, mm-hmm. Which is really good for our school.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to see more of is participation of multiple sport athletes.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I try to tweet out as much as I possibly can are all those anecdotal examples of multiple sport athletes that get drafted in the NFL, for example. I think something like 83% ran track. We're looking for kids that do multiple sports, and I meet with a lot of recruiters, and invariably somebody will say, what else does he do besides football, or what else does she do besides basketball?
Because you're seeing, what, a greater emphasis on kids just specializing in one sport? Is that what you're saying?
We try to avoid that. There seems to be that trend to specialize because parents
because
make
what, parents think that's the way to get a kid into the NFL or Major League Baseball?
Maybe more scholarship related, you know, to go to college. I think that sometimes that's short-sighted because that multiple sport athlete will most likely get more looks than that one and only sport athlete.
Yeah, Dr. Goldstein, again, you're nodding your head. Multiple sports, that would be your recommendation?
So in 2015 in the NFL Combine, 87% of the players admitted to playing multiple sports.
87%.
And I think Patrick Mahomes is a fantastic explanation and great description for Kansas City. Not only is he an excellent player and a great addition to Kansas City, but he played multiple sports and made it to the top. And, you know, it just proves to the parents and the athletes that think, if I don't play year-round soccer or year-round baseball, and that's the only sport I dedicate my time to, I just won't make it. But the truth is that, you know, the odds of being a high school football player and making it to the pros is about 1 in 6,000. And that's about the same in every sport. High school basketball, about 1 in 10,000 make it to the pros. A high school soccer player has about a 1 in 90 chance of making it to a Division I or Division II NCAA team. And so you could play multiple sports and still achieve greatness, as we see in NFL players today. And the burnout is less when you play multiple sports. The injury, overuse injury, such as Little League elbow and Little League shoulder, is less when you play multiple sports. And certainly the fun is more when you entertain yourself with more than one thing to do during the entire year. Yet we know that year-round sport is vital to coaches and athletes and parents that are dedicated to that sport. At least during that year-round time, if you're a year-round soccer player or year-round baseball player, at least during some of that time, mix it up with something that doesn't have anything to do with that sport. For instance, swimming or an off-team time.
Right. Do your athletes have any sense of what Dr. Goldstein was just laying out here, the statistics that suggest that any one athlete's chance of making it to the pros really aren't very good?
Yeah, I think they have a really good idea.
Oh, they do. Okay.
But, you know, for them, you know, we don't want to restrict their dreams and their aspirations. You know, there's a kid from our school from 2009 that pitched in the major leagues, Mike Morin. And he was a big kid, but he was the first part of his high school career as a multi-sport athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they know that the odds are long. We don't want to take them away from their dream, but the big deal is they have to be realistic about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would add that, yes, somebody has to be that one in 6,000, and it could be your kid, and I agree with that. Somebody has to be the one person that makes it to the pros. What we want to try to prevent is the injury or the burnout that occurs that really makes them not one of those one out of 6,000.
Yeah.
So sure, your kid could be that person. Somebody is. We want to make sure that your burnout is decreased, your injury is decreased, your fun is increased to make that reality.
Well, just for the record, I tell the little kids in my neighborhood that I played for the Packers back in the 80s, and as they get older, they increasingly figure out Mr. Kraske's not really all there when it comes to that. How about players being prepared to play in the heat? What should the players and their parents be thinking about as summer is cropping up here, Dr. Johnson?
Well, all our coaches undergo heat training. There's mandatory through the Activity Association to do that. We have...
That's pretty strict these days, isn't it?
It is pretty strict.
Because every year you hear these horror stories, and there was one at a junior college out west that K2R Sam Zeff has talked a lot about, offensive linemen collapsing and dying in the heat out west. You
right.
Know?
Our coaches know we have ice and water available immediately to submerge someone who looks like they're dealing with heat-related issues. It's right there available to our athletes. It's centrally located. The trainer's in charge. Everybody kind of knows what the indicators of are of getting too hot. And I think we have a pretty good protocol in place, but the first thing is being able to identify the indicators.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those indicators?
Well, I think some of those indicators for our coaches are they sluggish? Do they look different than where they are? Are they complaining about, you know, how they feel? And, you know, one of the big areas is immediately contact the trainer, and when in doubt, go take them to the tub and put them in the ice water.
Yeah. Didn't I used to take salt tablets when I was a young football player in junior high and high school? I mean, that's just the opposite of what you're supposed to do, right?
And they told you not to drink water.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, it's totally changed. Drink as much water as you can and make sure you're hydrated.
What concerns do you have as the summer season approaches, Dr. Goldstein?
Yeah, hydrating before the day of the event. So if you're expecting to be practicing on a Saturday, you should be starting to think about hydrating on a Thursday night or Friday.
Really?
Don't drink a glass of water right when you're going to the event and think that that was enough. And making sure that, you know, cramps can be a sign of the beginnings of dehydration. Vomiting can be a sign of the beginnings of dehydration. Stopping sweating is a serious sign. And so there are some signs that happen before an emergency. But just know that as a sports injury or illness, dehydration is 100% preventable. Mm-hmm. Drinking water, Gatorade, eliminating energy drinks that have caffeine or sugar or taurine in them, and sticking to Gatorades and Powerades and waters, and knowing that water is the most important thing. If your activity is an hour or less, water is all you need. Start the day before and make sure that you're urinating the same amount of time, the same frequency as you always do.
What if you're working out every day, you're preparing for the football season, and practices are a daily thing?
Yep.
You're talking about a lot of water.
It's a lot of water, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And monitoring your weight shouldn't change after a practice. It should stay about the same as your pre-exercise weight, and watching your urine output that you're still peeing at the end of the workout.
Mm-hmm.
Those that stop sweating or that can't go to the bathroom, those are real hints that we're not going the right direction.
Right. You know, which sport, Dr. Johnson, tends to cause the most injuries? What do you see? Is it still football or is it something else?
Well, I think those are the ones because we have the most players on a football team, and mm-hmm. and those would be the ones that would indicate to be the greatest number. But we obviously have injuries all over the place. Gymnastics and basketball and soccer, you name it, we have them. But, you know, we have 100 football players out.
What's the most common injury you see?
Well, other than the normal aches and pains, I would say the one that we're most focused on are concussions. I wouldn't say that that's the most common per se. You know, there's injuries.
But again, the thinking there has evolved a lot the last 3-4 years,
well,
right?
Well, yeah, unbelievably so. And because, you know, I was, and Dr. Goldstein and I had known each other for a long time on this. We were in part of that transition where, you know, it got to the point where you had to rest your brain the same way you rest a muscle that was pulled. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that you couldn't go out and watch practice because you were being held out because of a concussion, coaches would get mad, parents would get mad, but it was different than the orthodoxy that we had all been taught.
Mm-hmm.
And now we understand the science of it a little bit better. And so there's a specific protocol to go through. And I think, by and large, people accept that, rely on it, and it becomes very effective.
Dr. Goldstein, what's your advice to parents who come to you and say, my son wants to play football, we're concerned about concussions, what do you advise? How do you handle
it? We need another half hour.
Yeah, I was wondering. Yeah.
That's a great, great topic. And boy, you can see both sides of the extreme on that.
Mm-hmm.
Football is an exciting sport that's part of the American, you know, the American backbone. And I love the sport as well. And yet the concussion numbers seem to keep rising. The science keeps coming out. And different advisory boards, as well as professionals like Dr. Cantu, who's a concussion expert, says we should be allowing kids to play flag football or touch football until the high school age, or they shouldn't be wearing helmets until a certain age, or we shouldn't be tackling on practices only during games. You can see the cons of all those things too. If you're not practicing, how do you get good at it? And if you're not learning to tackle at a young age, how do you expect to be good when you're in college? And there are certainly both sides to that. I will say that concussions are a hot topic and a big, not only a big science topic, but a big media topic. And they're mostly put on football, but we know that it happens with bicycling, and we know it happens in soccer, and we know that it happens in every sport and slipping on the ice in your driveway.
If a kid wants to play football or a young woman wants to play soccer, would you ever advise no out of fear of concussion?
No, that's a great question. I think today the recommendations that most sports doctors use is the number of concussions that someone's had or a concussion that hasn't resolved. Either they're still having symptoms or their grades have dropped or their personality has changed. And those are real red flags that perhaps we should be thinking about a sport that's non-contact.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that we should be running in fear of concussions if you've never had one or because you're scared you might get one. Because, as I said, you could slip on the driveway in the ice and get a concussion. Concussions aren't 100% preventable, but we should be able to monitor the risk. And if the risk is too high, perhaps find something that's less risky or less contact.
I'm just wondering about your coaches at Shawnee Mission South, John. And, you know, you have a great football player, and he might get his bell rung and you have to go through protocol and taken out of a game. Or, I mean, that's a lot of pressure on a coach who wants to win a game. You got your star player dinged up.
Well, I'll tell you how we relieve that pressure. I give 100% of the authority to the trainer to pull that player.
Okay.
And
it's not a coach's decision.
It's not a coach's decision. It's the trainer decision. And it is absolute. I've told every one of my coaches, when the trainer says they're off, they're off.
There's no arguing there.
If you want to argue, argue later, but you're not going to argue now.
Yeah.
The state of Kansas and Missouri also have laws that are predictable in nature that athletic trainers and coaches and athletic directors know. That if there's a sign of a concussion, you don't have to diagnose it. You don't have to be the doctor to diagnose it. But if there's the sign of a concussion, they have to be pulled for at least 24 hours, and they can only return after they're sent back by a concussion provider. So I think that takes some of the pressure off of coaches, although the stress is still there if they want to be playing their best player, I understand. But some of the pressure gets taken off when the coach can tell the parent, you know what, it's the law. We have to take them off. We're not only doing it because it's the law, we're doing it because it's the best thing for your kid.
That's the voice of Dr. Randy Goldstein, a pediatrician and sports injury specialist over at St. Luke's. We are also joined by Dr. John Johnson, who serves as athletic director at Shawnee Mission South High School. Gentlemen, thanks for some great information. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. Last week, we talked with two researchers about what the facts tell us concerning women who choose abortion and why they do it. Hear what they had to say in previous conversations. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Wednesday on the show, thinking of adopting a shelter dog, animal behaviorist Wayne Hunhausen will highlight their special needs. Join us tomorrow for that conversation. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Devin Davis. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.